eastern boundary.
Yeah.
So when this site was selected, that was my main concern, because the eastern side of the site is open because of the marshalling yard, and so there's limited ability to screen. I explained coming out of the MCA process, that's why we went away and worked out that we had to move the NIMT away from those houses so that we could fit a noise barrier in place. So as Mr. Lloyd's raised that area's concern, that was the concern, and they are still impacted, but the levels with the barrier are reasonable at those houses.
Oh, I see. So that opinion may have changed now that there's been that modification.
So Mr. Lloyd has made that has expressed his opinion after the modification.
Yeah.
So I originally shared his concern that the effects might not be able to be mitigated, whereas I've satisfied myself now that they can. There's a question, potentially, the barrier is a very expensive bit of infrastructure, and I don't know if you weigh up buying another dozen houses against building the barrier, but it doesn't make sense in terms of the sustainable use of that land. And if you can maintain the residential use of those houses in that community, then I think that has to be the preference.
Well, that does have some rationality about it. But is it your evidence that at the levels that you've predicted, the most appropriate response, if necessary, is internal levels of amenity, but not acquisition of the land?
Yes, that's my opinion.
And if the designation extended that far, you would then say a person has to sell their land or it has to be acquired unless they choose not to. And is the point that they've lost that choice? Is that the point?
I think so. On Transmission Gully, there was one property near the main construction yard on Lane's Flat. And in my opinion, the construction noise and vibration effects could not be adequately mitigated at that house. And the house was included in the designation as a result. The owner turned up to the hearing and said, I don't want to sell my house, I want to stay. But in my opinion, there wasn't a BPO that could reduce those effects to a reasonable level. In this instance, I think there is, and therefore it's not necessary to designate those houses.
Yes, but testing this question of at least if the designation was wider, there would be choice. The question we then confront is, why is choice more reasonable than professional assessment of appropriateness? In other words, the giving of a choice, in some sense, seems reasonable, but why is that a substitute for a professional assessment of the appropriateness of the levels that they might experience, even if they are an increase? You know what I mean? Like saying, well, they should have the choice is not an acoustic assessment. It's a political assessment. They should have the choice. That the acoustician should say, is this level appropriate or acceptable or reasonable or not? You see what I'm saying?
I think so. So my assessment is that the levels can be mitigated so that they are reasonable without designating that land.
Yeah.
So
that's an assessment by an acoustician.
Yes.
Saying, well, they should have the choice whether to accept that level or not, is not an acoustician's assessment. That's a planning or political assessment.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes. Yeah. So
So your assessment is it is reasonable, appropriate, but it is a diminution from a level that might be expected if they had a northeast industrial zone and they were within the same property. In other words, it's a diminution in amenity of that to that extent.
Yes, my assessment is clear that there is a significant change in their environment as a result of this project.
So do we fall into the logical trap that because that level of amenity is deemed appropriate for most of our edge situations, it has to be applied everywhere, irrespective of the nature of the activity? You know what I'm saying? Like the proxy for reasonableness becomes the existing measures that we apply as opposed to some other form of assessment. Well, it's true the level is less than what the plan has decided is appropriate adjacent to industrial zones.
It's higher.
But that's not the only measure of impact. It's just different. How does an acoustician assess or come to a conclusion about reasonableness, given that you might apply a higher standard to an industrial zone, but it might not be appropriate to apply it to a facility of this size and scope? In other words, you know, if you were establishing a port, would you necessarily apply an industrial standard? My question is, it might be reasonable for industrial, it may not be for that, but what is the objective judgment? How do you make that judgment?
So I can explain how I've approached this. So the issues that you've raised do not have a standard assessment framework, and different people approach it in different ways. In terms of how I've approached this situation, so as I said before, the ideal is that you meet a similar level to the existing plan rules allow for, and in some cases that will be achieved. However, you can't reasonably operate this very large piece of infrastructure in any peri-urban area and meet those criteria, in my experience. And therefore, there's a leeway where you can treat houses to achieve reasonable internal levels, even if the external levels are higher than desirable. So the question as to how do I make that judgment that it's reasonable? So the internal levels are at a level that allow people to sleep, to read and concentrate and rest and relax and conduct their normal activities inside. The external levels are higher than desirable, but you're still able to talk to each other without shouting across the barbecue. So residential activities can continue to function without a particular impact in that noise environment. So on that basis, in my opinion, the levels are reasonable. For the people who experience the change from the current situation to the future situation, there's a significant change, both in level and partly in the character and the duration and so forth of the noise. So that's where there isn't a agreed assessment standard applied under the Resource Management Act. And to some extent, it's very much an individual impact. So we've been talking a lot about the wind farms, and one of the residents in Makara who went through the consenting process, and when the wind farm was built, they couldn't stand the noise. They moved out, someone else bought the house, they didn't notice it. Some people lived in that community and accepted the change, and so the effect of that change is very much a individual response to the noise. And as an acoustician, we can't drill down to those individual sensitivities at this assessment stage.
Right, and so that's the point about Mr. Lloyd's point about choice. He probably would agree it's an individual response, but at least if you have the choice to sell, you can get out. But let's test that assumption. Choice would equally be available to sell. The question is there a reasonable basis to conclude that the market would not operate appropriately in the sale process? In other words, there would be a reasonable number of buyers willing to buy in that environment such that it doesn't markedly depress the price.
So,
And my question is, can we learn anything from the market that's currently operating around the existing railway to tell us something about the presence of choice? In other words, is there evidence that people who currently live very proximate to the railway are having difficulty selling their houses?
So I don't know. I don't have the evidence on that rail.
I'm just exploring this because we have this proposition the designation is too narrow, it comes to a choice. But if the market's operating adequately, there is choice.
So there was a study done on this specific issue on the Hawke's Bay Expressway some time ago. It was Opus looked at the sales figures for turnover of houses on the row of houses next to the expressway and a controlled row of houses not next to the expressway. And if I'll have to pull up the figures. If I recall correctly, the value of the houses was the same. The time to sell was slightly longer on the houses next to the expressway, but they were still selling within a reasonable time frame. So on that particular set of circumstances, it was concluded that the market was still operating.
I'll give you another example. I was assisting the Board of Inquiry in relation to the Wiri Prison, and one of the issues was the impact of an additional correctional facility on the perception, self-perception of the neighbourhood as a desirable place and its impact on values. As far as I know, Manurewa is booming. Like, in other words, that fear may not be rational.
I think I'm in danger of going outside my lane on in terms of the noise exposure. The conditions are reasonable for residential use, and on that basis, the houses should still be perfectly marketable. In terms of the human factors and the issues around the property market, I can't comment further.
Well, but it is, in a sense, we have to act rationally, and I mean, there's a very good example immediately in Palmerston North, which is that neighbourhood, and if the market is functioning perfectly adequately, then isn't that some rational evidence that it will continue to do so in Bunnythorpe?
From a lay perspective, it makes sense. I just can't contribute meaningfully to the factual basis for that.
Yeah, I'm just testing this because it's a point that's been made that the designation is not wide enough. But alongside, if the point is providing choice, the obvious side of a designation is removing some people's choice because their land is then subject to the statutory limitation that you cannot act in a way that defeats it. So if you want to build a minor dwelling to accommodate your granny, they say, oh, well, no, that you can't do that because that's subject to the designation. So, extended designation doesn't expand choice for everybody.
I also don't understand what the end point is. So I've advised KiwiRail, particularly on that north end by Maple Street, they had to increase the size of the designation significantly to get a noise barrier in a place where it would work. My advice to KiwiRail was that was reasonably necessary to mitigate the effects of this proposal. My advice to them is that the effects of the proposal can be mitigated with the eastern noise wall on the moving the North Island main trunk in. And I can't give a rationale why that extra land should be designated. And where do you stop? The noise from the project is, it's changing the environment, it's having an effect some distance away. And I don't, if there's not a rational basis in terms of noise levels as to why a piece of land needs to be designated, you could argue the designation should be 5 kilometres wide. I don't know where you where you draw the line. And so I've drawn the line at where I consider the noise levels are reasonable, and I can't speak further as to
Well, no, I think that's your job. Anyway.
I've meandered an awful lot. If I may just check through my summary statement, and I suspect that we've already spoken through each issue, but if I can just make sure there's nothing that I've missed before we move on. Apologise for the lack of structure. So just to confirm that, as well as the operational noise we've been talking about, I've also looked at the construction noise and vibration and the operational vibration. I've spoken about the existing environment. And then for the operational noise, I spoke at length about the modelling. For the construction noise and vibration, I've based my assessment primarily on experience of the nature of construction works and the typical distances over which effects occur on other projects. For operational road traffic noise on the new perimeter road, I've made an indicative calculation of the noise level from the new perimeter road. And for operational vibration, again, I've based that on indicative vibration from experience with other railways. I've talked a lot about controls for operational noise, so I won't do that further. For construction noise and vibration, I found that standard controls should be adequate to manage the effects, and I've recommended a standard construction noise and vibration management plan framework to manage those effects. I'll turn to conditions at the end, but I've made various recommendations to Kiwi Rail as to practical systems to manage these effects, and they're all represented by the conditions. In terms of matters of agreement, my reading of Mr. Lloyd's evidence is that we are largely in agreement on the big picture items in terms of the appropriate criteria and the general level of effect from the proposal. So I didn't see any disagreement in that. Reading submissions, there's a lot of residents who have spoken about noise and vibration effects. And I found in my assessment that there will be particularly noise effects over a relatively wide area, so there will be effects on those residents. That this isn't a case where I'm sitting here saying this is all less than mine or anything like that. There are effects from this proposal. And with submissions as well, there's some submitters have spoken about the benefit of constructing noise barriers as soon as possible in the process. I agree with them that anywhere it's practicable to do so, that would be good practice and should happen. But I think, as Mr. Skelton ran you through, there are constraints into how quickly the east wall can be constructed. There's also a few submissions that have sought modifications to some of the noise barrier alignments. Already touched on the one by Maple Street. There is scope to refine that, and I think that should happen through the detailed design. For the barrier on the western side, I don't believe that's appropriate. Just the District Health Board submission. So Mr. Goodwin isn't giving evidence to this hearing, but I've met with him and discussed the points before he made the submission. I agree with him that it should be Kiwi Rail offering to paying for the treatment of houses. I agree with that the best practical option should be adopted. And I also agree that I've changed my position and agree that special order characteristics should be penalised where they're shown to exist through objective measures.
So that could be just a particular carriage that's got really squeaking all the time and that sort of thing, or
It's unlikely to be an individual carriage. It's more potential. It's more likely to be a container handler with a. It's more likely to be a piece of equipment with either a fault or a tonal alarm or all of those things. Most of the large items of equipment are stacked full of condition monitoring devices. As those devices, as the instrumentation technology's got better, most when you pay how many millions for your item of equipment, it has a whole load of performance monitoring, but mainly to protect itself, to avoid costly repairs. So that stuff should be picked up, but if it's not, then that's the scenario where it may arise. In terms of agreement with Mr. Lloyd, as I say, I think we agree on criteria, largely. We agree that QRL should fund building treatment. We agree ventilation should be included. We agree it should include upper floors, even if the lower floor is screened by a barrier, that should consider the upper floor if it's not. And that the treatment should occur before the noise exposure occurs. So it should never be a case of wait to see if you can get away with it. And if you get the complaints, then run out there. It should always be done proactively in advance of the noise. In terms of the, I'll come back to conditions. Mr. Lloyd made various recommendations to conditions in his evidence. There are a fair number of those which have been put into Mrs. Bell's evidence. There's now another iteration, though, with a few more minor tweaks. So there are some of those which I agree with.
So are you going to take us through all the noise-related conditions?
Yes.
Can you walk us through them? Because our difficulty is that we're not just dealing with noise. We're dealing with a whole range of expertise and different conditions. And for myself, I'm losing short-term memory. And so let's walk through all of the noise and vibration conditions.
Certainly.
With time to read them so that we understand how it works.
Yes. In terms of areas of disagreement or outstanding issues, many submitters have talked about a curfew. I understand you've heard from Mr. Moyle around the, and Mr. Skelton perhaps, about the operational needs for operating at night. So I've proposed a framework that mitigates the effects adequately of operating at night. And while a curfew would be one way of avoiding effects, given the fact the activity requires that to occur, I consider you can manage the effects in another way through treating houses if you need to. There are a lot of submissions, and Mr. Lloyd as well, who've made comments about detailed information. So as I've stepped through already, particularly on the operational noise, I consider I've gone through a process that correctly establishes the envelope of effects, and then I've proposed a mechanism for that detailed work to happen when those details are known. At this point in time, I cannot tell you exactly what models and makes of equipment will be operating on this site at what particular times and exact locations. And without that information, I could produce you another noise model, but the uncertainty associated with that is greater than any utility it may bring. So I've produced a noise model to generate the envelope, and that detailed design, in my opinion, should only follow at the outline plan stage.
So are there conditions that require QRL to identify regularly potential sources of emission that would alter the current assessment that's been carried out so that there's no gap where you're sitting there and then, oh my goodness, they've put all the stuff there and I now need to respond to that?
Yes. Yes.
That's covered up.
There are some submissions that have raised personal health conditions. All of the noise criteria that I've applied relate to the community response to noise, and that's the way in which working on noise assessments for Resource Management Act matters, the way I've always approached them, and that's the way in which I understand it's normally done. I acknowledge that there are particular personal health conditions which will result in different effects, but the assessment is based on a community response to noise. I mentioned before about the realignment of barriers. There's a submitter houses down here has requested for this west noise barrier to be the to the west of the perimeter road. So at the moment, that red line is sitting on the edge of the operational freight hub area, and then the perimeter road is down the page from it.
Is that Mr. Keniston?
Yes. The issue is that at Robert's line, at this point here, the perimeter road is 2 metres lower than the site, give or take. So the So the site is at 50 and the perimeter road is at 48.
48, yeah.
So if the barrier goes beside the perimeter road, it's only sticking a metre up into the site.
Yeah.
So given the fact that the barrier isn't needed to mitigate effects from the perimeter road, it would provide a benefit, but it's not needed. But it is needed to mitigate effects from the site.
Yeah.
I, in my opinion, it should stay on the site. As I've mentioned special audible characteristics already, I disagree with Mr. Lloyd and the Health Board that subjective tests should be allowed. And in terms of conditions, I should probably just start going through the details. There's a few points.
So you still stick for an objective method for SACs, but there is a mechanism through the community liaison and the management plan to change methodologies if there is a particular human.
Absolutely, yes. And in my experience, that is the issue. I've recently been at Eastland Port for sort of looking into issues, and the issues that the community are concerned about almost always relate to the human factors. I think the liaison system is an overarching condition. It's not specific to noise, but I think that forum, and then with the operational noise management, I think that is the most effective way to address those issues.
You might be interested to know, I understand that the complaints have diminished a lot up in the hills with the litigation process.
Good. So if I step through the conditions now.
Right. So what page are we on those?
So, before I go to the noise ones, I'll just, if we go to page 3 about outline plans.
Yeah.
And if on condition 9, just to highlight that item 9C is the construction noise and vibration management plan. And on the next page, item 9I is the operational noise and vibration management plan.
Sorry, what are you saying?
On the next page, 9I, the operational noise and vibration management plan. So I'm just flagging here that the high-level conditions require those two plans to be submitted with the outline plan.
I think it's J.
Yes, on the council side of the page, it's J, and on the other side, it's I. Sorry,
on your side, yeah.
On the left-hand side, it's I. On the right-hand side, it's J.
Yeah.
There's no disagreement. It should be there. It's just,
okay.
So just flagging that the process for requiring and submitting these two management plans is all set at that in the higher level conditions. So then, if I jump into the construction conditions, construction noise, which starts on page 33, condition 68. But for ease of reference, I'll work down the right-hand council side, so we're all looking at the same thing.
Right.
So the noise conditions are split between the construction ones and the operational ones, so we're going through the construction ones first. Mm-hmm. There are very minimal differences between Mr. Lloyd and myself on construction noise and vibration matters. It's mainly how it relates to planning and wording and so forth. So just running through those conditions, 68 mandates the implementation of the construction noise and vibration management plan.
What's the difference between a construction and and enabling work?
Good question. In terms of construction noise and vibration, the management plan should apply to management plan or plans should apply to everything. If enabling works are geotechnical site investigations, the chances are there will be no construction noise and vibration effects, so the management plan may only deal with it very briefly. But the important point in the is that there's a framework where it can be assessed whether or not there is an impact, and if there is an impact, what control measures need to be worked through. So there will be a whole load of minor activities which are quieter than activities going on at the moment on the site, which won't need any particular controls, but the plan should cover everything.
Dr. Charles, just while we're on the construction noise and vibration conditions, just note that Mr. Lloyd expressed a concern around the likelihood of construction works, particularly I think during the summer months, occurring sort of later into the evening than would normally be acceptable, and that that he felt that, I think from memory, that was quite a high likelihood, and suggested that there should be provision in the I think it was in the construction, perhaps it was the construction noise and vibration management plan, it may have been, to provide for that likelihood. I just wondered whether you are aware of whether that provision has been made, whether you have a view on that.
I need to refresh my memory on the precise thing that Mr. Lloyd was referring to, but I can talk in general. So in condition 71 on this same page, there's a table of noise levels, and that's the standard table out of the New Zealand standard, and that table has got a shoulder period in the evening from 6 till 8. So the noise limits step down, or they step up in the early morning between 6:30 and 7:30, and they step down in the evening between 6 and 8, and then they're lower again at night. So that standard provision, I understood that Mr. Lloyd and I were in agreement that limit structure was appropriate. While this site is large, the actual impacts on houses, because the site's large, there'll be activity over a relatively long period. But the site's huge, it's kilometres long, and the amount of activity near to someone's house, which will be at those higher levels, will be for shorter periods of time while they're constructing the noise wall bund near the house will be the noisiest time. So there will be activity audible. The criteria put some upper bounds on that, but in reality it will be less than that for a lot of the period. I would say, in terms of the hours worked, with construction, there's always a balance in terms of the contractors. They can only work through certain months when the conditions are dry enough and so forth. And there is always a balance between prolonging the overall exposure against getting it over and done. There's no right and wrong answer to that equation. And the way in which I think it should be addressed is through compliance with that performance standard in terms of the noise limits. I did condition 68, so there's no agreement in principle on what the council are proposing to change. It might be wordsmithing things. Likewise, condition 69. So 69 is saying the construction noise and vibration plan is all about managing, trying to achieve showing how you achieve the noise and vibration limits. So it refers to conditions 71 and 72. 71 contains noise criteria, 72 contains vibration criteria. Condition 70, it's the plan's got to be prepared by someone who knows what they're doing. And the council have suggested adding in a reference to the New Zealand standard, and I agree that's perfectly appropriate. There's a in the back of the standard, it sets out what should be in a construction noise and vibration management plan. Condition 71 is the construction noise limits, and as I've just said, they're straight out the standard, and I don't think we've got any disagreement on those. There's minor wording changes which don't change the meaning.
In some ways, the council's version speaks to the submission, KiwiRail and the submissions about what should be in a condition around a management plan, so it's quite useful.
I'm now on page 34, looking at condition 72. So this is a table of vibration limits. The vibration limits, so this is a Waka Kotahi standard set of provisions based on a couple of international standards. There's a category A and a category B on vibration limits. And this is because vibration, there's huge variation in sensitivity to vibration of both people and buildings. And so the category A gives you a safe level you should aim for where there's highly unlikely to be effects. But in the bit between A and B, in a lot of cases, it's still likely that the effects will be acceptable. But there's a requirement there that you take a more proactive look at those effects. And then category B provides an upper limit, which can't be exceeded unless you're actively monitoring the building or whatever the personal building that's being affected. On the next page, the council have added in an explanation of that category A and category B, and that explanation should always have been there, and so we're in agreement. That's correct. So I'm now on condition 72A.
Can I just stop you and go back to the 72D there, which is about category B criteria, vibration effects? What does it mean in the last sentence, because you've just generally said that you agree with it, by and shall be mitigated in accordance with that person's recommendation? What shall be mitigated?
The vibration effects on the... At this point, it's most likely to be a building effect. So the tolerance of buildings to vibration is highly variable. The German standard that's often used has three categorizations. It's a house, or it's a industrial commercial building, or it's a sensitive historic building, which is quite crude. So the sensitivity of houses to vibration varies a lot. If you're below the category A criteria, you should not cause any cosmetic damage to any house. Between the A and the B, you still probably won't cause cosmetic damage. The B is the British standard thing for criteria for damage. Beyond the B, you're at risk of damaging the house. So the mitigation in all cases will be surveying before and after and fixing any cosmetic damage that occurs. You wouldn't exceed the B unless you've had a structural assessment saying there's no risk of structural damage to a property. And it may be that there's a, usually with vibration, you monitor the vibration on the property as you start the activity further from the property, and the engineer's looking for any movement in the building as you move closer. I can't give a specific chain of mitigation or management measures because it's entirely dependent on the particular structure.
And what you've just explained, I don't think is reflected through the condition as drafted in terms of what might be mitigated. And if we were just talking about operational noise before, where if there was an effect on somebody's property, there would be an agreement process with them and mitigation occurring. So that seems to me to be missing from this.
Yes. You're right. For all of the major roading projects, this is the form of condition that's been used. And in practice, when you go to someone and say, can I conduct a pre-conditioned survey of your house so that if any damage occurs, we can repair it, people can't refuse. Theoretically, they can, but in practice, otherwise they
are unlikely to. I've seen other conditions constructed which are a lot more clear in terms of the process around dealing with vibration effects on buildings.
Can you tell me which project?
Funny enough that I was involved with, Somerset Bullcott in the hut, which was a direct referral to the Environment Court, so it's easy to find. Yeah.
Helpful. In terms of what we're trying to achieve, in terms of how conditions are best drafted, I'll work with this panel on that.
I feel that I had to question it, that there was a lack of certainty there.
Okay. Turning to 72A, so this is a condition that Mr. Lloyd has inserted relating to night works. In terms of the intent and the actions that he's describing, I'm in agreement with what he's trying to achieve there. I consider that should all be done through the construction noise and vibration management plan, which is in condition 73.
The question then is, whether that needs to be a condition and expressed in that way or part of the objective for the noise management plan, because what that's giving us is some valuable information about outcomes. And it may be too strict to call it should be as a condition. I don't have a view on that yet.
So I think it's more describing process than outcome. And there's no disagreement in terms of the process that should occur. There's most of those steps are already captured in 73A to J. And if those need wordsmithing to make sure it's more explicitly covered, then that's appropriate. But the use of a construction noise and vibration management plan is standard in industry and people understand it. We've already looked at the previous condition that says it's got to be prepared by a suitably qualified professional. And it's a accepted, known, understood practice, and that helps in it being effectively implemented. And so I think if these requirements can be captured in that existing structure rather than being an add-on outside of that requirement, I think it's likely to more effectively manage the effects.
Yeah, I mean, I do understand that point. However, there are a number of aspects about it. It has both process and substantive impacts. So, for example, the works cannot be practically undertaken during daytime hours. It's not a process. It's a standard. But the others, I agree with you, are process requirements. So there's a number of components to it. And I think it's important to distinguish between what are outcomes and what are process. But I don't necessarily accept that outcomes, if they aren't, shouldn't be subject to the rigidity of a rule, are nevertheless expressed as desirable outcomes of the particular management plan. So that, you know what I'm saying, that there is a little bit of flexibility, but you're clear about what you're trying to achieve. And here the intent seems to me to be pretty clear, that you don't just make decisions on the basis of convenience to the operator to operate at all hours of night for long periods of time, particularly during the summer when, you know, people might sit on the deck or whatever. So I think there's some value in the idea, but I agree with you that it's perhaps the location.
If I may reflect upon your points with Ms. Bell and come back with the wordsmithing around that, so I think a minor point on 72AC, Mr. Lloyd's thrown the word sensitive receivers in there, which the council officer's version have introduced that as a defined term relating to air quality, so we just need to make sure we're not getting mixed up with our defined terms.
Isn't sensitive receiver a standard term in acoustics? In other words, it's used in the standards?
The road noise standard and the wind farm noise standard have slightly different. So I don't think there's any disagreement between Mr. Lloyd and myself about what a sensitive receiver is.
Right.
In the way the council have framed the air quality conditions, it's become a loaded term. And it's just avoiding that loaded term when we use it in the noise.
Right. Okay. Well, we need to look at that. On that note, we'll take a short break and resume at 3:45. Because the energy in the room has fallen. It's all your fault, Dr. Charles. So we'll just have a cup of coffee.